I'm Alexia Ridley with Athens News Matters, a show dedicated to local news, current events, and community outreach efforts. Today, my guests discuss the most recent developments in the 2016 allegations of sexual assault at Cedar Shoals High School. We also discuss items on the state legislative agenda and the upcoming public meeting for the Athens Comprehensive Plan. Those topics and others coming up. Hello, I'm Alexia Ridley, host of Athens News Matters. My guests today are Blake Aud with Flagpole and District 9 Commissioner Kelly Gertz. Thanks for joining us, Kelly. It's been a little while.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
And one of the things we're talking about right now is Cedar Shoals. That was such a huge case when it happened. That just was in the media when it finally did get to the media, but it was certainly a topic of interest for everyone in the community. And it's kind of ending a little quietly compared to how it actually got so much public attention in the beginning. Blake, what can you tell us a little bit of the background in this case?
Well, it really shocked the community. I mean, it was one of the biggest stories in Athens, you know, at least in the past several years. But, you know, a sexual assault in a school in the middle of the daytime, and nobody was told. But it, as it turns out, you know, according to the court system, it wasn't actually sexual assault at all.
Which is surprising.
Which is very surprising, yeah. I mean, this is not the outcome that I don't think anyone really anticipated. But back in January of 2016, I'm not really sure how to phrase this. Do I say allegedly for something that, like,
allegation
it turned out actually
was?
Not happen, but that there were allegations that three Cedar Shoals students had raped a 15-year-old classmate in a stairwell at the school. And the three students were not suspended. No one was notified, you know, not the parents, not the students, not the teachers.
And not the community.
Not the public.
Nobody.
No one, except for, you know, school board members and a few people high up in the administration who didn't say anything about it. But it only came to light about a month later when Joe Johnson at the Banner Herald, their crime reporter, was going through the jail log and noticed that the three students had been arrested and charged with sexual assault, and got all the background information. And of course, there was widespread outrage, you know, all over the community, not even just on the east side, that you know, this had supposedly occurred in a school and no one had been told about it.
Because regardless of your child having gone to Cedar Shoals or any other school in the district, you wonder at that point, well, what protocols are in place to protect my child and protect the population at large?
Exactly. And so, you know, everything from, because of this community pressure that resulted, I mean, everything from the way that law enforcement communicates with the school district and the internal communication, you know, all the way down to the attendance policies, you know, the student code of conduct. All of these things were reexamined and really and redone, you know, for the benefit, really, I think, of the district and all of the students, because there were all of these sort of underlying issues that got dredged up that, you know, were related to this, but also, you know, existed in a much broader fashion that really needed to be dealt with. So the ultimate result, I think, was a good thing. But, you know, this case, you know, kind of went through the system, and these things take a while. And then there was a little blurb back in November in the Banner Herald about how the main sexual assault charges against these three students had been dropped. And there was no follow-up, so I asked Ed Morales, who used to be the editor at the Banner Herald, now edits the Terry Colleges magazine, but does a little bit of crime reporting for us on the side, sort of for fun, but that's the kind of thing that's fun for Ed.
Crime reporting for fun. A real news person there.
Yeah, so he looked into it. He got all the court documents and talked to the attorneys and everything, and it turned out that what happened was there was some evidence that emerged in the form of some text messages between the alleged victim and one of the students who had been arrested, that led a grand jury to believe that no sexual assault actually took place, that this encounter was actually consensual. And so Regina Quick, our new Superior Court judge, heard this case, and the prosecutors wanting to drop the charges and dismiss most of them and have, I think, one of the students they wanted to serve an additional year. But as it turned out, they were all basically sentenced to time served on a misdemeanor charge of child molestation because of the age difference between the three students and the girl. Because they were 18 and she was 15, so.
Can I stop for a second just to recognize that it's fascinating to me that it's Flagpole, it's our weekly news and arts magazine that's provided the most illuminating coverage of this tail end of the case when, you know, as we've talked about in this room before, you'd hope that in any community there would be so much investigative activity going on that multiple sources would have been digging into these same documents that Ed Morales uncovered. And we talked about it when Jim Thompson was here as a staff person at the Athens Banner-Herald. I mean, these are the kind of details that community members would have wanted to have had covered extensively really all along over the last 2 years.
Yeah, and the coverage really did peter out, I thought, which is unfortunate. You know, and this is not the kind of thing that Flagpole ordinarily does. We don't get into a lot of crime because the Banner-Herald... because Joe usually is so good and on top of things, and you know, we try to like fill the niches that aren't being filled being an alternative paper. You know, we kind of specialize in, you know, politics and food and music, and the Banner-Herald does crime and sports,
but you filled
but in this but in this case, I mean, it was something we noticed that hadn't been covered, so you know, we went on and covered it. But it's the type of thing that could easily slip through the cracks, I think, in the current media environment that we have, where, you know, the Banner-Herald's down from, you know, 30 newsroom employees down to like 8, maybe 9, you know, because of all the cuts at the corporate level.
That's hard to overcome.
And it's really frightening. I mean, they don't have a full-time government reporter even, you know, like they've got... Lee Shearer is a terrific reporter. You know, he's doing
some wonderful writers there.
Athens, Clark County government, and Oconee County, and the school district, and UGA, which used to be four separate beats for four different people.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you an idea of just how
stretched thin
that they are.
And so the public almost has multiple frustrations here. They have the frustration over the procedures or lack thereof that occurred both within the Cedar Shoals building and perhaps in the district at large, but also the frustration of lack of access to information about them because they're such an anorexic, attenuated news system in the Banner-Herald. But I don't want to lose the main thread. I mean, I have to at least put some level of responsibility both on the district level and on the building level. I served as a building administrator here in the district, and I have to say there were any number of times when there was a formal criminal charge, but I also undertook the procedure of assigning somebody to out-of-school suspension at the very same time, almost in an opportunity to both clear the air and provide a forum in which to do some information gathering. You know, anybody in the criminal justice world will tell you the most important information gathering is that happens most time proximate to the event. And certainly in any building, whether you've got 200 kids in your building or 2,000 kids in your building, there can be all kinds of spin-off trauma and drama that can follow an event like this. So I think there are a lot of responsible parties that should have been acting at the time.
It's sad to think of an alleged victim and alleged assailant together for so long in the school. It seems very difficult to sort it out, but there should be some sort of protocols, as you said, to kind of get them separated.
Absolutely.
Well, how, you know, Kelly, you being you were a former principal. So, I mean, if you were the principal of a school where something like this type of situation occurred, how would you have dealt with that?
At least one of the things I would have wanted to have made sure is that, following up on Alexia's thoughts, that those individuals weren't together in the same building immediately after this alleged assault. And again, recognizing that these are allegations, some of what you do if you send kids to out-of-school suspension is be very upfront with parents and say, you know, we're not sure quite what happened, but clearly there's a lot of tender ground here. We're going to do everything possible to protect your child's educational rights in the next, say, 5 days. You know, we're going to have teachers communicate with you. We're going to send work home. But what we don't want to do is create an additional powder keg by having those folks in the same building or potentially even in the same classroom.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the district has become a lot more sensitive to I think keeping parents and the public involved, as we saw last week where there were some rumors going around on social media of a school shooting, at least, I believe, three schools in the system, I think.
I was aware of at least two.
At least two, yeah, if not three, but, you know, which turned out to be just hoaxes, bad jokes, whatever, you know, but they were very cautious, I think, in investigating those, and they did alert the parents promptly, you know, that to tell them the information that, you know, we've heard this is going on. We don't think there's anything to it, but we just want you to know that we're taking it seriously.
And we're in a communication environment where this stuff spreads so quickly through group texts, through social media. And so, you know, in a school of 1,600 kids about the size of Cedar and Clark Central, in any amount of time, it can move from a small cluster of kids to essentially the entire school population.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you know how gossip spread when we were in high school, and that was before phones or Facebook
right.
or anything.
That's
so
right. You actually
imagine.
Had to interact with somebody in the boys' bathroom.
Or pass a note.
And yet it got passed. So putting it on social media, so many people have access to it almost immediately. And the district did post it on their Facebook page pretty quickly.
That's
they
right.
got it right out there so you could at least get that first pertinent information, something's going on. So that was there.
So from the public perspective, it certainly seems like there are some lessons learned from the Cedar Shoals incident. It's the other thing that, Alexi, I want to make sure just is out there in the public realm is, you know, none of us are omniscient. No judge, nobody in those courtrooms is omniscient. We don't know exactly what happened. We, you know, certainly know that the cases have now been disposed of. Some of the component of the article had to do with this sequence of text messages. And as I read it, one of the things that occurred to me is that some of the rationale for the case having been dismissed with only minimal charging going through was that there had been some prior text contact between the alleged victim and one of the alleged perpetrators. Alleged perpetrators.
Right.
That's right. And, you know, a single yes to you know, a sexual opportunity is not a lifetime yes, you know, and so certainly sexual assault can follow a consensual sexual activity that may not be something, sadly, even in 2018, that's in the public mind, but it needs to be.
Well, you're absolutely correct about
that. I agree, Kelly.
I would just only point out that there were text messages exchanged before and after, which I think was
okay.
the—
So that's where—
That's what the, hinged on it, you know, that—
The confusion, perhaps.
They were graphic in nature, and we probably shouldn't really get into what they said.
No, but we won't do that.
So,
but that's why that kind of clouded the issue, certainly, in this case.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, according to Collins' defense attorney, you know, it really hinged on the fact that, you know, the girl sent, we'll say, complimentary text messages to one of the students, both before and immediately after.
Right. So, this just seemed to be a big mess. And I guess now we're going to move forward from it how we can, and those involved are hopefully moving forward from it in a better position. I don't know what to say. That was just...
traumatic.
It was. It was. It just seemed
after the community at large.
It is, you know, after a trauma like that in the community, it just seemed to just kind of fade away, but now we move on.
Well, Blake, thanks to you and to Ed for digging into this.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Blake. It was good to see that all the information that Ed put in there, and I know you probably had to sift through it yourself to edit through it, but it was good to get as full a picture as we've seen on this incident. And I guess we'll move on now to the state capitol. And along similar lines, one of the topics up again is the campus rape measure.
Back for its second year.
Well, not back, actually.
Okay. Campus rape measure, not back.
It is still alive. This is a bill that was introduced by Representative Earl Earhart, a Republican from Cobb County. And he is of the belief that there are many innocent young men who are being railroaded on bogus sexual assault charges on college campuses.
I thought the stats showed that the overwhelming majority of sexual assaults do not go reported.
That is very true. Yes. That is very true, and it's also
but
true.
But he has some different
It's
stats.
Also true that there are few people who are falsely, very few false
of.
Reports.
Right.
So those are the facts, but Representative Earhart doesn't agree with those facts, and so...
So we're going to narrow in to the most myopic territory possible.
And so he thinks there should be a higher, that basically colleges and universities should be reined in from investigating sexual assaults on campus, that they shouldn't really be allowed to do it. But in light of the Trump administration changing the burden of proof for these investigations under Title IX, which is a federal law regarding...
Provides equity of opportunity by sex.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
That was very succinct.
Yeah, wasn't it?
That's what happened when you teach American government for 7 years.
They've rescinded the Obama rule that universities should be investigating these and that they should be decided on what's called preponderance of evidence, which is basically 50% plus one, you know, when you're weighing it on the scale. Which is a very low burden of proof, but then again, we're also talking about, number one, you know, a civil proceeding. It's not a criminal proceeding. And number two, something that's really very difficult to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So there are issues of, you know, is it fair to the survivor, you know, if we are holding them to an extremely high standard. But all that aside, because of the uncertainty regarding, you know, exactly on the federal level how public colleges and universities are supposed to be going about this, the House and Senate Higher Education Committee has put this bill on hold, at least for the year. So that's good news. It could come back, you know, it could be reintroduced next year. based on the comments from the Republicans who are actually on the committee, it sounds like they're pretty satisfied with some tweaks that the university system has made, which don't go nearly as far as this bill, but seems to have satisfied, you know, the concerns that the legislators who supported this bill had.
It's so difficult for victims anyway to come forward, and having to shoulder more of the burden of proof is pretty difficult.
And I would say difficult for university administrators, too.
Yes. You know, well, they have to follow what the state sets.
Right.
Yeah.
Who wants some clarity without being micromanaged?
And I think that the university system did a good job of heading this off with the minimal amount of damage, negative effects, I think, on the process would be a good way to put it. So,
okay, so that is not back. All right. So what is something that is on the agenda, Blake, at the Capitol? Medicaid expansion?
Well, you know, the Democrats have introduced a Medicaid expansion bill, you know, which they
as per standard
usually do.
Yes.
This is really for political purposes. It's not going to go anywhere, although there had been some talk the past couple of years of Republicans being open to something resembling Medicaid expansion, where maybe they would do like what Kentucky or Arkansas did and go get a waiver from Health and Human Services where they could set up, you know, their own type of program with that funding. But House Speaker David Ralston kind of shut that down a few days ago and said they're not really into it. But it's been interesting. The legislators that I've been talking to since the session started, I guess, what was it, 3 weeks ago? This is the slowest that anybody can ever remember it. I mean, they've done nothing. So there's not really a whole lot to talk about.
Even though they've technically had days in session.
Yeah, I think they're on, what, day 10, 12?
I think they're beyond that. That's right.
Maybe,
and the anticipation is it's going to be done by April.
Yeah, probably sometime in late March, definitely before the Masters. You know, that's always their goal is to get out
before the
Masters.
So our bookends were, fortunately, UGA going to the Rose Bowl and the National Championship. And then we'll end with, okay, the Masters. Those are the let's try to get some legislative
in an election
issues.
Year for everybody in the State House and State Senate, the
right.
big goal is
Which
to get
means,
back in fundraising mode.
Right.
And it also means lots of bills introduced that aren't really going to go anywhere, you know, and not much actually being done because nobody wants to antagonize anybody. So
you wonder if, you know, we would be advantaged by going to a system like Texas where the legislature meets every other year.
The less they meet, the less damage they can do.
or, as would probably be my preference, to at least have 4-year terms for all these folks so that there's only one of these election year, what you might call jello cycles, where almost nothing happens.
That's not a bad idea. Well, and one of the things, I think there's two things that go into it, too, that are kind of interesting. I think, number one, you know, with all the special elections that the Democrats won, you know, I think they see the wave coming and they're trying to figure out, like, how do we deal with the fact that, like, Democrats are making a comeback.
Mm-hmm. There are going to be a lot of strong statewide candidates this year.
And number two, Amazon, which is almost the same thing, because that sort of paralyzed them into, you know, well, we can't do anything that might upset Amazon, you know, like, we'll just leave it
like,
shh,
like a new riffraff.
Don't talk about that. Like, you know, we can't. Don't even mention it. But
yeah, well, those 55,000 jobs, they speak.
Yes,
they do. But it is interesting also to note that this is Nathan Deal's last year in office. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, you know, depending on what happens with the Amazon site selection, he may go out with more of a whimper than a roar. That's and some of these longtime legislative goals of his, you know, a reconsideration of the K-12 funding formula that's the largest single line item in the state's budget may not be touched.
That never, you know, that never has happened.
That's right, after a two-year study committee worked on it.
That's been the third rail of Georgia politics for a very long
time. Since the 80s, absolutely.
So much progress. Well, we will progress to something else right now, and that is the upcoming meeting for the comprehensive plan. And that comp plan is a big deal. It's a 10-year project, so people need to go to this meeting, which is going to be next Wednesday at from 5:30 to 7:30. And the public is invited, correct?
That's right. So that's February 7th, the Planning Auditorium, 120 Doherty Street, where the Planning Commission meets.
Great. And, you know, obviously, Kelly, you know, having served in office for so long, you know people need to be there to have input, to let people know what's important to them.
And I think this is a particularly critical time for a comprehensive plan, given that it's come on the heels of the Envision Athens process. And so the idea is that the comprehensive plan, which is a required thing that the Department of Community Affairs has to have the county submit every 10 years, is not just a punch list of saying, oh, we're going to tweak our sign ordinance here, or we're going to modify our sidewalk requirements there. But the idea with Envision Athens and in this version of the comprehensive plan is that it was a much sort of bigger, higher flying document that would say, you know, we really have some deep community goals, and here's how we're going to begin to achieve those goals.
And this is, and while these are two separate things, you know, as Kelly mentioned, they are related because Envision Athens was a much broader process, which had to do with all aspects of the community, not just the government.
That's right. Multiple institutions,
sure,
school district, public health, CGA. University.
And then, but then that the government aspect or portion of Envision Athens was pulled out, and that became the basis for the comp plan, where they took all that public input and they used it in the comp plan. So it's almost a subset of the comp plan that's kind of been expanded upon in a way. But these are, they both just came out a few days ago. They're online at athensclarkcounty.com. You know, they're pretty lengthy documents. The comp plan's pretty dry, as you might expect. Envision Athens, you know, at least they threw some, like, you know, nice colorful pictures and charts and stuff in there, so that might be a little easier to read.
But when you're talking about community considerations as huge as affordable housing and our transportation network and the future of transit, these are things that are going to have a huge impact on the public as implemented.
Yeah, and the it is not a thing that is going to sit on the shelf. You know, I mean, the comp plan is something that local governments, it's required by the state, and local governments are required to follow it.
And we have to report our progress in increments.
So the things, you know, the goals and the policies and everything that are listed in this, if we don't do them, we at least have to explain why. So, I mean, this is a very important document that really is going to guide pretty much most, if not all, of the decisions that the Athens-Clarke County government is going to be making.
Including that biggest decision every year, what our budget looks like.
Sure. And that, but this is the only opportunity to comment in person on the draft. You know, this process is all happening very fast now because Envision Athens took a little bit longer than expected, so the comp plan really kind of came under the gun. And now that the draft is out of this meeting on Wednesday, hopefully there's going to be a recommendation to go ahead and proceed with this throughout the rest of the process, but this is going to be really the best opportunity to comment on it. They're also taking comment online. But only until the end of the day Friday, so you just have a few hours to hop on the website and go ahead and, you know, read through it and submit your written comment if you'd like to do that. But if you want to show up and speak in person, this Wednesday meeting is really the best opportunity to do that because it will come back for more public comment. But at that point, you know, it'll already have gone through the commission at a work session. And it'll be really at the point in the process where there are not really going to be any kind of major changes made to it. So,
and in terms of sequence, that Wednesday, the 7th at 5:30, there will be presentation first with public comment following. So there will be some context for that public comment.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, of course, you can read it to prepare yourself, read it yourself if you'd like. And they also have display set up at the planning department that you could actually go through 5 o'clock today. You could actually go down and kind of look at their maps and everything. They've got all that set up and get a staffer to kind of walk you through it.
You can at least read it to see what questions you have. You know, you may just need to go in person just to kind of get a better grasp on some of the
And there's a ton of information in there. I mean, you know, there's a lot of great background information, statistics, you know, that are really interesting. And it's a lot of bullet points, you know, it's a whole lot of information. But, I mean, it covers everything that we talk about on the show, you know, all these issues, you know, development, land use, transportation, I mean, housing, affordable housing, environmental issues.
We're definitely in a data-rich period these days.
Yeah.
Similarly, if people have not gone to the Athens Wellness Project website, I'd encourage them to look there at a lot of human impacts of these macro-level issues that you're talking about, Blake.
As you said, Kelly, we're talking about major issues in the community that they're going to impact all of us. Something in this plan is going to impact everybody in Athens.
Right. What it feels like to roll out of bed and at your front door in the morning.
Right. Right.
We haven't even mentioned economic development, you know, jobs, what kind of jobs that we want to draw, you know, where those companies would locate, you know,
how we get people. Which we need to be thinking about.
How we get people to those jobs, you know, how we solve our poverty issues. I mean, all of these things are interrelated.
Yeah, and you can't think about one without the other. You know, I talk about this a lot as being sort of like one of those medical encyclopedias where you've got the transparency pages and you have the pulmonary system on one page and the skeletal system on the other page and you've got the lungs on another page. And all of these things are what make up our community.
Right.
All right. Well, that will be the last word, Kelly. You'll have that today. If Gwen were here, she would have it. do want to thank my guests, Blake Odd and District 9 Commissioner Kelly Gertz. To hear this show again, visit WUGA.org for a podcast. For questions or comments, visit our Facebook page. This show does not reflect the views of the station or flagpole. Athens News Matters is a production of WUGA, a broadcast service of the University of Georgia. I'm Alexia Ridley.